So wheat is incredibly important.
That's right, it really is. These are, and wheat, rice, maize, potatoes, these really are the legs of a stool that we sit on in terms of nutrition across the globe. And of course, it's not homogenous around the world. If you go, you know, you said it's 20% of our calories globally, but you know, of course, in Western Europe, it's the crop, you know, it's the major crop. And it is, it's also the world's most traded crop. So even for countries that you wouldn't really think of as wheat producers, certainly, they're highly reliant on wheat, often, especially as they urbanize. So, for example, African countries, biggest importer of wheat in the world is Egypt, and the populations are really dependent. And you see, when you get crises like the Ukraine crisis, where for a while it looked like wheat wasn't coming out of Ukraine. Ukraine is one of the big five or six in terms of global wheat exports. You know, the price of wheat rocketed. It went well over £200 a ton. And there were immediate consequences to that for food security all around the world. Every year is a record wheat production year. You know, we at the moment we're on about 780 million tons with a population of 7.5 billion. By the time we get to 2050, we're on 9 billion people. And there's genuine questions, is it whether wheat production can keep track with that population increase, especially, as you say, when the pressures of climate change are actually pushing against wheat production. And the real killer, the thing that a lot of people don't realize, is agriculture is one of the main greenhouse gas producers. You know, in order to get those wheat yields, we add a lot of ammonium nitrate and urea to the soil. That is produced at very high greenhouse gas cost. And then double whammy, you add it to the soil and it produces nitrous oxides, which are some of the most potent greenhouse gases. So I don't know how you square this. We've got the world population is not going to stop. They're all going to continue to eat more wheat. And in order to produce it, you're going to have to produce more greenhouse gases in a world where agricultural production is threatened by climate change. So there's real, you know, grand global challenges that we have to get together to work on. And that's why, you know, you won't do this without the type of collaboration we've talked about. We had no qualms about working with China. I'd say Chinese food security should be as important to the US and the UK as their own is, because the consequences of this going wrong are frightening.
And so the varieties, the germplasm, the genes, the alleles that you're discovering, these lost alleles that never disappeared, they were always there, conferring resistance to drought, resistance to high temperature, resistance to diseases that proliferate under conditions of climate change.
There's, you know, genuine traits that we could chase for all the traits, all the things you've just talked about, but also to reduce the impact of agriculture.
It's a gold mine.
It is a gold mine. So it was Shifeng, my colleague, who said that to the journalist. It's a gold mine. And we always worry about overstating for those. You know, when you get a big paper and it's in the press and you don't want to raise public expectations beyond what is reasonable. But I no qualms about it. It's a gold mine.
Simon Griffiths, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
It's been a pleasure.
Simon Griffiths is group leader at the Delivering Sustainable Wheat Program of the John Innes Centre in Norwich, England. Read more about his group's work and the gold mine Arthur Watkins bequeathed the world at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, subscribe. With your help, we'll keep delivering stories about planet Earth, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. At the International Court of Justice in The Hague this past Friday in an 83-page advisory opinion addressed to the UN General Assembly that solicited it, the UN's top court declared that Israel's 56-year belligerent occupation of the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and Gaza, is unlawful and that Israel must terminate it in short order. The self-declared Jewish state must also stop building settlements. The ICJ advised the United Nations evacuate all its settlers, allow Palestinians to return to their lands, and compensate them for the losses and damages they've suffered. The last time the ICJ issued an advisory opinion on the so-called Israel-Palestine conflict, back in July 2004, it focused on the separation wall Israel was building largely on Palestinian land. The wall was illegal, the court declared, and an infringement of the inalienable right of the Palestinian people to self-determination in their historic homeland and had to come down. Israel ignored the order, and the international community hasn't enforced it. ICJ advisory opinions are non-binding. They do carry enormous judicial weight, however. The GPM spoke about the ICJ's advisory opinion on the legal consequences of Israel's prolonged occupation with Michael Link. Link is a Canadian legal scholar, a retired faculty member at Western University in Ontario, and former UN Special Rapporteur on the human rights situation in occupied Palestine. The GPM reached out to Michael Link in London, Ontario, days before the ICJ advisory opinion. Hello, Michael Link. Welcome to the Green Planet Monitor once again.
Thank you very much for having me, David.
Michael, International Court of Justice is going to be issuing its advisory opinion on Friday, July 19th at 3 p.m., The Hague time. And we're speaking before then, we're speaking 5 days prior to that. You've been waiting for this for years. You've been talking for years about the importance of having another advisory opinion from the court. 20 years ago, 2004 was its first on the legality of the wall. And when you were special rapporteur, you were advocating for a new advisory opinion, I think. What are your thoughts in the lead up to this advisory opinion? It's going to be historic, I think.
Well, obviously, it's going to be, I think, groundbreaking in both their contribution to international law through this advisory opinion, but also specifically with respect to the Israeli occupation of Palestine. So if we go through this, there have been a number of scholars who had raised over the years the idea that an occupation cannot go on indefinitely with the occupying power taking steps to annex land either directly, as Israel did with East Jerusalem, or more covertly, though not really that covertly, by placing hundreds of settlements and hundreds of thousands of settlers in the occupied territory, all with the aim of being able to establish a permanent sovereignty claim by Israel over these occupied territories. I wrote a report early on in my tenure as special rapporteur analyzing the issue of illegal occupation and concluding, based on the fact that Israel was breaching all of its obligations as an occupying power, and concluded the occupation had become illegal. And in my conclusion, my recommendations, I asked for the United Nations General Assembly to ask for an advisory opinion from the International Court of Justice with respect to whether or not the occupation had now crossed the bright red line into illegality. And it took a number of years for it to consider this, but eventually the question was put to the General Assembly at the end of 2022, just as Benjamin Netanyahu was about to resume his rule as prime minister. And the General Assembly voted overwhelmingly in favor of asking the International Court of Justice for an advisory opinion. And then all during 2023 were the preparations that went on, and the arguments were finally heard over 6 days in February 2024 in front of the court. And that drew the largest number of states and international organizations ever to argue a case in front of the International Court of Justice. And there are over 50 states and I believe three international organizations recognized by the UN argued in front of the ICJ. And now this coming week, we're going to finally hear the advisory opinion to be released by the court.
And there were all sorts of fascinating arguments. Amongst the ones that I found the most fascinating, the distinction between jus ad bellum, which is the legality of actually going to war, and jus in bellum, the legality of behavior and acts of the occupying power once the war is over and it is an occupying power. And so I found this really interesting. And there were people, representatives of the various states, who argued that Israel's occupation was unlawful from the start, that it was unlawful jus ad bellum, that even just this idea that the 1967 war was not this doughty little country fighting off an awful, perfidious invasion by its Arab neighbors, it actually instigated it. It had no legal right to go to war. I found this fascinating.
Well, yes, there were certainly a part of the arguments that were heard in front of the International Court of Justice that dealt with the issue of what happened in 1967. Most countries did not address that. There were a handful of states and organizations that did address that and said, as you pointed out, the occupation was illegal from the very beginning. In my own mind, I think that's a fascinating both legal question and historical question, but it didn't seem to me to be important to raise in front of the court, because the court would have been reluctant, I think, to delve into the historical question. And I'd be surprised if the court actually addresses that question on when it releases its decision on Friday as to whether or not the occupation was illegal ab initio right from the very beginning. I think most of the arguments made in front of the court were whether or not the war in 1967 was an illegal war, whether or not the occupation was illegal right from the very beginning in June 1967. The occupation, once Israel's, I guess, intent to want to start annexing land and to prioritize its own interests in the occupied territory as opposed to those of the people under protection, that is the, I suppose, the starting question. That's where most of the states wound up starting their particular arguments.
And the core of most of them was that Israel's presence, occupation in the West Bank, is no longer really an occupation, as occupations are defined, and that it amounts to the unlawful acquisition of territory by force.
Yes.
Can you talk about this concept of the unlawful acquisition of territory by force?
Sure.
Which, if I understand correctly, was spelled out or promulgated in UN Security Council Resolution 242.
Yes. Ever since the end of the Second World War, with the growing acceptance by certainly countries in the global north who were then the members of the United Nations. Remember, when the United Nations was created in 1945, there were, I think, 54 members of the United Nations, most of them European or North American countries, or countries like Australia and New Zealand. And today we're at 193, which is almost four times as many countries. So the United Nations of 1945 accepted or was reflective of the powers of the primarily of white European countries that had been engaged in empire building.
And so if I can stop you there, and so in the UN Charter, right, I mean, I can't remember the exact wording of Article 1, but that, states shall not attack other states. States are sovereign and shall not violate the borders and the territories of other states. But there was nothing in the UN Charter that actually declared the acquisition of territory by force to be illegal. This wouldn't be enunciated until 1967.
You're right. And what happened in the aftermath of 1945, with the embers of war still glowing, was the acceptance of the fact that wars of aggression leading to an accepted annexation of land through conquest was now going to be illegal. And that was the implicit acceptance of what happened in Article 2, Subsection 4 of the Charter of the United Nations in 1945. And that had been reinforced by other practices of the states in the 1940s and 1950s. And it then reached its crystallization, as you correctly pointed out, David, with UN Resolution 242 in November 22, 1967, where the United Nations unanimously repudiated the use of war or force to annex territory belonging to somebody else. And that's been reiterated, I believe, in eight subsequent UN resolutions. That's one of the most central points of law in international law today. And we can see through historical comparison how the outline of annexation didn't eliminate it, but it certainly dampened it significantly from examples that we can look at prior to the beginning of the Second World War. So international law does have an effect. It's the same as saying we ban murder in our criminal code. That doesn't stop murder, but it certainly dampens it by prohibiting it and by then punishing it as well. So if you want to be an honored member of the international community, the expectation is you're going to obey international law. And that doesn't always happen. And certainly the example of Israel and Israel and the United States is a clear example of the exceptionalism with respect to that. But by and large, countries obey the rule that you cannot use force to annex territory.
Do ICJ rulings carry the force of law? Do they then become established law? So, for example, if the court were to rule that Israel's occupation, permanent occupation, is indistinguishable from apartheid, would it then be correct to say that Israel has been found guilty of committing the crime of apartheid? I mean, there's no individual criminal responsibility associated with that. That's the job of the International Criminal Court. But having declared that Israel's settlement enterprise and its presence in the West Bank as an occupying power is no longer legal and is in breach of the law, would that be a defining canonical statement, if that's the correct way to say it?
Yes. It's accepted that decisions and advisory opinions of the International Court of Justice do make law. I mean, certainly the decisions that the International Court of Justice has made with respect to South Africa's application under the Genocide Convention with respect to Israel, those provisional measures are considered to be legally binding. The decisions of the advisory opinions of the court are also considered to be legal decisions from the highest court in the UN system for this. But what they've been asked to do is an opinion, if you like. And that opinion has been asked for by the General Assembly. We'll go back to the General Assembly to then decide what to do with this. I would suspect whatever the court winds up deciding, that the General Assembly will then probably pass a resolution, will likely pass a resolution endorsing the decision. And then the question is what to do. And as you're making very clear, international law needs to also have international resolve in order to be able to put a decision or an advisory opinion into effect. And there we have to see what the United Nations will do as a body.
And it seems obvious to me that if the ICJ comes out with a really powerful ruling, its impact or potential impact will have to be kind of calculated in the context of, you know, the ICJ's provisional measures order in South Africa versus Israel on genocide, and the International Criminal Court's proceedings, Karim Khan's application for arrest warrants against Netanyahu and Yoav Gallant. And that, for those who are wondering, well, what's the impact of an ICJ ruling going to be? The answer is, well, you have to see it in the context of everything else that's happening.
You do. And obviously, international law has moved very slowly with respect to trying to impose accountability on Israel. That is the enormous hole in the heart with respect to how international law has reacted to Israel's ongoing illegalities in the way in which it's conducting its occupation. We know that annexation is not only illegal and with direct reference made to Security Council resolutions, but it's a crime of aggression under the Rome Statute. We know that settlements, putting civilian settlements by an occupying power into occupied territory, is not only illegal because the Security Council has said so on a number of occasions, but it's also a war crime under the Rome Statute of 1998. We know that the denial of self-determination, and self-determination being a core feature of international law, that Israel's denial of Palestinian self-determination is a serious breach of international law. And yet Israel is able to function as a member of the international community through its membership in the United Nations, and it's been shielded from any accountability measures through the use of the veto by the United States. People are saying this has to end. Israel cannot continue to fight a war that is an unfolding genocide, and it cannot continue with a long-lasting forever occupation without paying political and diplomatic costs for doing this.
I mean, Israel and the United States are demonstrating each and every day that international law is an empty shell, that it's possible in this day and age, if you're powerful enough or have really powerful friends, it is possible to simply ignore international law. And Israel is, seems to be a kind of a festering wound on the international legal order, on the international body politic, and it's possible to commit the most egregious crimes and not only get away with it, but effectively be rewarded.
Yeah. Well, let me make a defense of international law. Let me say that you know, almost all countries obey almost all features of international law almost all of the time. You know, we have a postal system, we have international communications, we have a trade system that winds up working because countries obey the treaties and agreements that they've entered into to make, if you like, the world function as it does. But yes, when it comes to some important geopolitical issues, and nowhere more glaring than Israel, we then have what can be seen as a failure of international law to be able to enforce its own rules, its own resolutions, its own laws with respect to that. And that certainly taints the efficacy of international law, and it raises in people's mind a cynicism about how well or how poorly international law actually works. And there's probably no greater sense of cynicism, justifiably so, than among Palestinians.
And getting back to an idea of mine earlier, there's obviously going, I think there's likely to be a synergy between the ICJ's ruling on Friday and what the International Criminal Court does, the trial, pretrial chamber in Karim Khan. And there's going to be an effect over at the CERD committee, the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. I was just speaking with somebody who's an authority on all this, and he was saying to me that he had kind of been anticipating that CERD would come out with their report on Palestine's interstate complaint against Israel, that Israel is practicing discrimination and apartheid, prior to the ICJ's advisory ruling, and that a CERD decision would have influenced the ICJ advisory opinion. But now the ICJ is beating CERD to it. CERD's been at it for 6 years, and one imagines, one wonders whether or not a really powerful ICJ ruling on Friday would kind of compel CERD to finally get a move on and opine on racial discrimination and even apartheid. Because if they did, it would be huge. And I'm thinking about the synergy between these various forces of international law.
Yeah, no, and you're right with respect to all of this. If the court does say that the occupation has become illegal, this will now be a centerpiece of virtually every General Assembly and Human Rights Council resolution from now on. The word illegal will be in front of occupation from now on with regards to this. If the court majority either says apartheid or they say serious violations of the prohibitions against racial discrimination, that too could have a significant impact on how politically the United Nations and many countries, member states of the United Nations, winds up regarding Israel with respect to its conduct of the occupation. So those are all important features to be able to say. As I said, it may be that the court says there are strong elements of racial discrimination going on in Israel's conduct of its occupation. Some judges may not say apartheid. I think other judges may say it is apartheid.
And this leads me to my last question. What do you think a powerful ruling, what the impact of a powerful ruling would be on individual state parties who are powerful state parties who are poised to do something like France, for example? Well, the French government has just changed. Macron is still there, but they've been talking about when the time's right, we're thinking about recognizing the state of Palestine. And with Ireland and Norway and Spain having recognized Palestine, one wonders whether or not suddenly a whole bunch of other states will step in and do the same thing or impose sanctions on Israel.
You're making a very good point, David. My sense of that, if there is a strong ruling on Friday with respect to the illegality of the Israeli occupation, with respect to features of racial discrimination or indeed apartheid as being part of its advisory opinion, then that will probably up the stakes, not only just for saying we should be, more states should be recognizing the state of Palestine, particularly coming from Europe or even Canada, because there's hints that Canada may do that as well. But it also would up the stakes with respect to taking meaningful issues with respect to sanctions against Israel. More states saying no more arms and weapons trade with Israel, reviewing existing trade agreements with Israel, deciding not to enter into trade agreements with Israel, enforcing boycotts with respect to goods and services emanating from these settlements, or indeed a total boycott of Israel, Israeli goods. The war has only further isolated Israel diplomatically and to some degree economically. A ruling of this sort coming from the International Court of Justice will, I think, only accelerate that kind of isolation. And I should add, it'd be one interesting thing between you and I, since we're both Canadians, is what the reaction of the government of Canada will wind up being to this ruling. The fact that Canada said they had, when the initial decision came out in January with respect to South Africa's application on the Genocide Convention, in Israel, where the Trudeau government said, we respect the ICJ, but we don't accept the premise of this particular action. Will they now continue to say that, where the occupation has been found to be illegal under international law?
So enormous latitude, enormous potential for a country like Canada to suddenly, the Trudeau government, to make a bold decision. And people, I guess, wonder, you know, who cares about Canada when all is said and done? But one can easily imagine such a thing. I mean, the Canadian government said, when asked, you know, would you execute an arrest warrant against an Israeli leader if an arrest warrant were slapped upon them by the International Criminal Court? And I think Melanie Joly said yes.
Yeah, well, quite frankly, they would have to say yes with respect to this. But recall that Canada issued a written intervention with respect to the ICJ back in February, where they simply said, don't answer this question, ICJ. It's only going to muck up direct face-to-face negotiations and make it harder for the parties to find peace. It was like, if you like, it was international politics and international law at its lowest. I think it was an embarrassment to Canada to file that objection to the court assuming jurisdiction back in February. So we'll see if Canada's changed its position once a decision comes out, particularly if it's a strong decision.
Michael Wink is a Canadian legal scholar, a retired faculty member in the Faculty of Law at Western University in Ontario, and former UN Special Rapporteur on the human rights situation in occupied Palestine. Read more about the International Court of Justice's advisory opinion on the legality of Israel's prolonged occupation, de facto annexation of the Palestinian territory, at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and Canada's Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out for now.